Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us, as always, here on The Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is David Arnold. His book is In the Front Table and In the Window. And we'll talk about that a little bit later because I have an interesting take on it. It was published this February by Viking. Named by everyone as like a most anticipated book of 2021, Cosmopolitan, Forbes, Barnes & Noble, BookPage, and others. His earlier work includes Mosquito Land, Kids of Appetite, and The Strange Fascination of Noah Hypnotic, which actually has been optioned by Paramount. The Electric Kingdom is a tough one to pigeonhole if you happen to be a pigeonholer, which I'm not. But as usual at the bookshop, I always get confused when something's like, this is published by Viking Books for Young Readers, but I don't really see it that way. And I do have it stuck back in YA, but the main collection of them are in the Front Table, because same thing with Maze Runner, Miss Peregrine, or I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier. These are books that, you know, people read and, you know, I don't like lumping them all together. I mean, yeah, it's post-apocalyptic. Yeah, it's set in the near future. It's populated by kids like Kit and Nico. Parents are pretty much out of the picture, like in the old Peanuts cartoons. So yeah, it's science fiction. And yes, it's coupled with time travel, which I wouldn't say that, except they do say it in the reviews. But I found it immensely readable, and I'm an adult, theoretically. And because other reviews discuss him, there's the enigmatic deliverer, who I probably wouldn't say unless it was already said in these other reviews, whose presence in essence drives the story, at least to a great extent. So you got, it's like a picaresque undertaking. It's a pilgrimage of a kind, and the journey rather than the destination is kind of paramount. And so, as I said, it's kind of worth a rereading because, well, I'll talk about how I felt when I first started. But anyway, with that introduction, welcome, David, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Sam. I'm glad to be here.
So I'm kind of worried about this interview because I really hate cilantro and I really love olives.
It's so funny. You put something in your bio seven years ago, and people, you know, that they don't tell you that'll be there for, because the, you know, the internet is forever. And but yeah, it's so funny how many times people have been like, now wait a second, you don't like olives? Yeah, I can't stand them.
Yeah, but cilantro tastes like soap. You know, I'm a charter member of the I Hate Cilantro Society, which
are you?
Yeah, and my brother too. Tastes like Dial soap. Mm. But I will say this, while I was preparing for this interview, this guy came to my house and had a look around, and I went outside and my socks got really wet, and I was thinking, it's horrible. And I had to change my shoes, and I got to put them on top of the heater.
Yeah, wet socks are the worst, man. Liars and wet socks. Yeah. And as I've gotten older, I would add like deeply cynical people too. I have a hard time with certain levels of cynicism, but we're talking about things we like and don't like. And
are you?
On my website, I don't know if it's still there. I need to go check. I had kind of included random things that I didn't like, and liars and wet socks are kind of at the top of my list. And I really just don't like olives. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're supposed to be selling your book, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway, as a bookseller, I'm always interested in a couple of things. One, the cover, and I've said this 1,000 times, is everybody who says you can't judge a book by its cover. Every single person who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover. And you have a really good one, because not only does it, do you have your book? Can you hold your book up? Do you have it?
Oh man, you know what? I do over here. I'll be right. No, we'll just leave it. Yeah, no, it's,
no,
you know,
no.
It's,
go get it.
I'll grab it real quick.
We're selling the book.
That's Jeez. Right. Yeah, this is me being super professional and not having my book right next to me. But yeah, here it is, The Electric Kingdom. And yeah, you know, I can't really take any credit for the covers. I mean, Penguin has been really great in kind of, looping me into the conversation early and letting me kind of be part of the decision making around the covers, I suppose. But I had nothing to do with the actual design of them. Teresa Evangelista has done all four of my covers.
Really?
And she's just been fantastic. So yeah, we had landed on a different cover that I really loved prior to this one. And actually they used it as a, I don't know how you pronounce it, a frontispiece, which mm-hmm. is like the first page of the book. And I guess, you know, I wasn't in the meetings, but there were a lot of strong feelings about it one way or the other. And ultimately it just sort of, there wasn't a consensus that it would, you know, I guess sell the book, which is kind of what you hope a cover will do. And I loved it. And so when we kind of shifted away from that as the cover, I always kind of was like, maybe I could convince them to still use that art in some way. And luckily they agreed and it's been great. But yeah, the cover that they ultimately landed on, it's perfect. It's so fantastic. And it really, you know, it sort of encapsulates so many exactly. qualities about the book.
Yeah.
There's a real narrative there, but it's also simple enough. And
the thing about this cool is that, okay, you kind of know, you get a whole lump of stuff in there because the way the spiral, the way that works, you know, something's going to happen that way. I always look at it right. like it's the outside of a jigsaw puzzle box, and you kind of know that right. something different is going to happen. And then, yeah. of course, you know, plus you got Harry there too, which is
right. Yeah. The dog. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with the dog and I had always kind of wanted to write that dynamic about a person who loves their dog. And I included a dog in my third novel, but it really wasn't a focal point. And I was excited to get to do that in The Electric Kingdom. So, but I love what you said at the very beginning about not feeling, I mean, you know, look, all four of my books have been quote unquote young adult. And that's great with me because I love, you know, I think some of the bravest writing in literature is being shelved in YA. And I have many friends who are just doing, you know, incredible work. And I'm just so privileged to get to be part of that. But I never sit down and think, okay, it's time to write a book for teens. It's never crossed my mind that I would create something for a specific age group. That sort of prescriptive element that comes with genres or, yeah, the age groups, it's just never been on my mind. So I'm thrilled that I'm here. I'm happy to be here. But it never has crossed my mind that I would write a book for a certain age group. So I love what you said there at the very beginning about that, for sure.
It's just from being a bookseller. It's just that I realize now, you know, it's not like, okay, I'm buying this book. Am I looking down at myself? Am I condescending to myself? You know, and you're not. No, you're not. Right. This is the book you like, and this is why you like it. And actually, as YA books go, it's accessible, but it's work for the reader. And well, it's definitely work because you know why. Because yeah. So yeah. And anyway, so and then I usually go to the epigraphs. Now there's a dedication that's almost kind of an epigraph.
Mm-hmm.
But then the epigraphs are the first one is they're short. Those who know the future don't talk about it, and that's by Ted Chiang, which also presages what's going to happen a little bit. And then the other one is from Westworld, which is under all these lives I've lived, something else has been growing. I've evolved into something new. And both of those are excellent. And I always ask, you know, did they drive the book or while you were writing it or afterwards you like looked for them or they just got popped into your mind?
Well, the Westworld quote happened after it was near the end. I had already had the Ted Chiang quote and knew that was going to be, I was going to be using that. Which I want to talk about that as well. But the Westworld one had happened. You know, I'd been a big fan of season one. I loved season one of Westworld. I was so excited for season two. And, you know, I always hesitate to criticize art because I know what goes into it. And I know how the process of just dedicating yourself to a thing. And, you know, the writers and creators of Westworld talk about ambition. I mean, the things that they were trying to do. And I feel like season one, they did it really well. And season two kind of lost its footing, I think. But I did hear that quote in, I want to say it was like the second episode of season two, maybe, when Dolores, I'm blanking on her last name at the moment. Dolores, what is her last name? I've got it right here. Abernathy, Dolores Abernathy says that. And I thought, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's exactly spot on to the book. And I thought, oh, that'd be cool to use a Westworld quote. So I kind of threw that in at the end. But the Ted Chiang was, you know, that was a turning point for me in my writing, really, was 2016, going into the movie Arrival, thinking I was going to see an alien movie. And, you know, when I left the movie theater, I was just like, what just happened? What did I just encounter? What was that experience, and how can I get more of it? And ultimately that led me to the source material, which is Ted Chiang's short stories. Stories of Your Life and Others is his, I believe it's his first collection of short stories. And I mean, just from the very beginning, I was hooked with those stories and his storytelling. And his second collection is called Exhalation, and it's equally as brilliant.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
They're both of those. I mean, heady, you talk about heady sci-fi and you know, it really, I mean, I had the seed for the idea, which we can talk about at some point if you're interested. I mean, the seed for the idea of the Electric Kingdom happened back in 2012. But one of the big turning points for me was 2016, seeing the movie Arrival, and then reading Ted Chiang's short story collections and seeing what was possible in sci-fi. You know, the thing I love about Ted Chiang's stories is as you're reading what's happening, you're not fully, or I'll speak for myself, I'm not fully connecting all of the threads. You know, there's so much happening and he's so smart. And so I'm not fully connecting everything that's happening, but there's an inherent trust built into the way he writes that allows me to just sort of let go of attempting to connect all of the threads and just trust that he's connecting all of the threads. And then once I've sort of let go, I'm able to just follow him through this brilliant story. And I think that was very much a North Star for me with The Electric Kingdom, was saying, okay, I'm okay if people who read the book aren't quite connecting everything, so long as they are able to trust that I've connected everything. I think Kirk has called it perplexing yet satisfying.
Yeah,
I thought that's the most, you know, that's the perfect, that's that I'm good. I'm great with that. That's kind of, that's what I get when I go to Ted Chiang. I'm perplexed, but I'm so satisfied. And
oh yeah, I wanted to talk. Oh, so anyway, yeah. So sometimes I think, oh, we're talking about the epigraphs. Is it really important? And see, what you've done is you've. So, and that's why I like them so much. And the other thing I wanted to talk about when I was talking about this genre bending thing is I watched that Billie Eilish movie last night, which I never thought I would watch.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's really, really good. And what you see in the audience is you see these girls crying. Mm-hmm. And it's like this thing they used to call Ur-love, U-R, like when girls with the Beatles. And you realize that this is like their first love, and what she's singing resonates so much with them. And when I talk about genre bending, so not only is it post-apocalyptic, not only is it a time travel, and not only is it like this pilgrimage, but it's also about relationships. And if you are a young adult, if you're a 15 or 14 year old girl or boy, when there's a budding love story in there, it's going to be something that you can either resonate with or anticipate or remember, both the good and the bad. So you dumped a lot of stuff in here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it definitely felt, you know, once I fully turned my attention to this book and decided this was the next book I was going to write, because it was a big pivot for me. You know, my first two books were contemporary realistic fiction. My third novel, The Strange Fascinations of Noah Hypnotic, it reads like a contemporary realistic book, but it has a surrealist kind of light sci-fi element. So it's more of a speculative fiction, but again, it reads more realistic. This was my first book where I was right off the bat. I mean, I'm not, it's set 20 years after the world has ended. And so it's kind of, it was a big pivot, and I wrote it on spec, which essentially is just saying, you know, I'm with the same publisher for all four books. But I was not, I did not want a contract. I was not trying to write this book under contract. There was just too much pressure. It would have been too much pressure because I was already putting enough pressure on myself about whether or not I was going to be able to pull it off. And so I kind of went into it thinking, okay, this is going to be something completely different. And, you know, my hope, I guess, is that if someone were to read the first three novels, that they would still see me in this book, And there very much are still components of it that I've touched on in my past books, but it is a huge pivot for me. But you know, my favorite artists and writers are always the ones that you never know what they're going to do next.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think it's natural. I think we all in a certain way are, you know, story input equals story output. So the things that we're consuming are going to percolate and then find their way out. And so the things that I was consuming, and honestly, I don't want to keep coming back to it, but the discovery of what sci-fi could be, which for me happened in 2016 with Arrival and then Ted Chiang, that really was a turning point for me. I think prior to that, I would have said, well, I really like the Battlestar Galactica reboot. I've liked that for years. You know, other than that, I wouldn't have said I was really a sci-fi fan.
No, and that was the thing is, well, we'll get to the flies. Yeah, we'll get to the flies next. But when I first started the book, I'm going, this isn't what I expected. Mm. Because, you know, it's a traffic jam and it's like a regular episode of Cops, not Cops. It's an episode of like ER or something like that, because you think, okay, I'm not going to give anything away, but you think, okay, this is going to be an emergency, blah, blah, right. blah. And then you see the billboard.
Yeah.
And then you realize, oh, there's something else going on here.
Yeah.
And then, so why don't you talk about, what year are we, 2046?
Yeah, so I think it opens, I'd have to go, actually, it's so funny. I do a little timeline for all of my books, just usually near the end of the process, I'll go through and construct this timeline. So I'm not using it necessarily to inform the writing of the book, but near the end of the process, I'll do a big timeline and then go back and just make sure that everything lines up. But with this book, you've got, if you count the prologue, you've got basically four points of view in two or three different, you know, timelines. So it really was, I mean, credit to my editor, Dana Ladig at Viking, who was just so many phone calls with her trying to keep it all straight. But yeah, it opens, I wanted to show kind of that the prologue was really important because I wanted to set the groundwork for a very normal world, like what kind of what we know the world to be. And so I thought, well, what's more mundane than a traffic jam? And kind of having this young married couple have their, you kind of see them be annoyed and she's pregnant and he wears his PJ pants. And I mean, there's definitely, I can't deny some autobiographical components there. But yeah, just like a very mundane kind of normal thing going on. And also, you know, there is sort of this idea of like a book opening the moment everything changes. And I kind of almost was interested in if I could write an opening scene where the reader felt like, okay, well, this is going to be the moment where the world changes. But no, it's really not. It's the moment where our main character's life changed. And I don't want to say too much, but it is character centric. It's not about how the world ended. Yeah.
You can tell a lot about a good book because when the interviewer can't say, there's so many spots that I can't talk about, which kind of pisses me off.
Yeah, but, right.
Yeah, but so, because it makes it difficult. But the funny thing about it is that I was thinking, okay, who's the protagonist? And then I'm thinking, well, is it Nico? Is it Kid? Is it the deliverer? And then I realized actually the protagonists are the flies. I mean, that's why the book exists. So that's the key. Talk about that, because that's what this book actually, it wouldn't exist but for that.
Yeah, it's funny because the flies really weren't. So for anyone who's not read it, I mean, the way the world ended, it's basically, it's they're called the flu flies because they're carrying a flu that's killing people, but they themselves also physically kill people. So it's sort of a mashup horror situation with the flies. I'm terrible with time with my own sort of life timeline. So I try to think back to when they really became part of the book because, you know, at the near the very beginning, I mean, so in 2012, I was a stay-at-home dad with my newborn son and was working like really in the thick of it with my first novel, Mosquito Land, when I had this idea for a house in the middle of the woods, a boarded up farmhouse in the middle of the woods. And I didn't really know who lived there, or why they were there, what was going on. And so that was sort of just in this file on my desktop. And over time, I would go dump ideas into this file and then kind of leave it. It was like that closet where you just shove everything and then close the door. And then you're kind of scared to open it up. And at some point, it occurred to me that if this was a post-apocalyptic world, there was going to have to be some element of, how did we get here? You know, what happened? And this is where one isn't inherently better than the other, but there is a big difference between apocalyptic books and post-apocalyptic books. And, you know, apocalyptic stories are talking about the end of the world, whereas post-apocalyptic is, it's not about how the world ended, it's about who survived and how are they navigating the new world. And that's, for me, that's just a much more fertile storytelling ground. I'm much more, you know, it shifts the focus from what happened onto who it happened to. So it sort of naturally shifts it from plot focused to character driven. So yeah, in thinking of ways that you could still instill danger and also have this sort of like element of the old world and how it all went down, I thought, well, it'd be great if it was something that, you know, the thing that did it was still kind of hanging around. And so I don't remember when it really became this sort of honeybee crossbreeding experiment gone wrong. But very quickly, you know, I had some early readers who were like, you know, you really need to kind of up the stakes a little bit with the flies. It kind of, I tend to be fine with, like, I don't, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, for example, where it's just, you've just got these two characters, and yeah, there's plenty of danger, and mostly it's the people that are still in this world. And I wanted to play with some of that in this book as well, but I really was more interested in creating almost like a new monster with the flies. I think, you know, I'd started thinking about if the flies were working in a coordinated effort, what shape would they take on? And at the time my kid was obsessed with octopuses. And I thought, what if it was like a giant octopus and you'd have the flies kind of like tentacles around a giant hub, and that sort of, the imagery of that became compelling enough that I could really focus on making that, one of the main characters.
For sure. And two things are, you bring the octopus back in later on, like in a little section, but in the beginning, yeah, I was going to mention The Road because it's just, everything's done. And it's kind of like, you got to worry about people and what they're going to do to you. And this book, right away, you see what they do to the deer and it's terrifying. And
yeah, the flies, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, Holy shit. I mean,
yeah,
it's way bad. It's really bad.
Well, and I have to credit my friend and fellow author, Jeff Sentner. He read an early draft where there is a pretty gruesome event that happens near the end of the novel, where the flies, I don't want to go into what they do, but they show us the full extent of their power near the end. And Jeff was saying, you know, and rightly so, that I needed, even if I didn't focus on it, because the book really isn't, you know, it's not a gruesome book. But he was like, you know, if you could show what they do early on, you don't even have to show the action of it, but if you could show what they're capable of early on, we're going to feel, that'll stick with us, and we're going to feel that throughout the rest of the book. And he was spot on, and it really did sort of, right away, you see, here's what they're capable of. Here's what these people who are still alive have to deal with and think about 24/7. And just showing that at the very beginning, it was a really great idea, and credit to Jeff for that, for sure.
Yeah, it was. No pun intended, it kind of bookended it because, yeah, in the middle, it's not gruesome, but you see what their potential is and you see what potential they still have at the end, especially given what happened.
It's hard for me to talk about some of it. There are quite a few reveals, and it's hard for me not to spoil things as well. So
yeah, and you know, the reviews have been kind of cool because they haven't really done it other than talking a little bit about the Deliverer.
It's really hard to talk about the Deliverer without spoiling anything, you know. And really, honestly, like when we've talked about sci-fi, and I've mentioned Ted Chiang and Arrival, and I mean, if you remove the Deliverer's character from the book, well, first of all, it wouldn't work. But if you did that, there wouldn't be any sci-fi. I mean, the Deliverer's character, the Deliverer is this omnipotent, omniscient character who lives in this house on top of a mountain and is able to connect all these coincidental threads in ways that shouldn't be possible. And you're not really sure what's going on with the Deliverer. And it's hard. Yeah, it's just it's a hard character to discuss, but it was a really fun one to write for sure.
Yeah, it's hard because also you begin to see the ripples of them before you really understand, you know, the red books and all that. So you right. see the ripples of what he's doing. And at first, I'm saying, wait a minute, he's really screwing this up. Mm. That's not what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. so, and then, and that's why I say, if you're a kid, that's going to be something you got to work at. I think it's important to do that. Like I am the cheese, like I said, you know, you need to work at it. And then when you get to the ending, yeah, you're heartbroken, but yeah, you have to work it. Okay. And then of course, at the end also, you're not quite sure about
things. Right. Right.
And that's also a great thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I'm a sucker for Christopher Nolan movies where you're kind of like, wait, what's happening here? But yeah, you know, to your point about kids reading it too, like I feel, you know, I've decided early on that it wasn't going to be prescriptive. My process of writing is I'm going to play out my idea to its fullest extent. And sometimes that, like the book I'm working on now, which I can't really talk much about, but the book I'm working on now is pretty straightforward. And so that idea played out to its fullest extent. It's not incredibly ambitious, you know, like, but I knew early on with The Electric Kingdom that it was a very ambitious project, and that if I played it out to its fullest extent, it was going to be quite confusing. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's what I said earlier about the reader trusting that I've connected all the threads, and hopefully the read is such that a reader would be able to kind of let go and just enjoy that sort of process, because there are plenty of question marks, and not everything wraps up neatly at the end. But I do think that you know, if you're confused about something, and you're done, I would encourage you to go, unless you hated the book, which obviously people will, reread it. My hope, fingers crossed, is that your questions would be answered if on a second read through, because my editor and I both worked really hard to make sure that it all made sense and the pieces.
Yeah, and that one of the reviews does say exactly that, and I agree with it too. I got all these interviews, but if I have the time, I will. It reminds me, like when I was a kid, I was reading like John Updike's first collection of short stories. And I was just a kid, so some of it, the sexual stuff was way over my head. So I wrote him a letter saying, you know, I love this story, but I don't quite understand what happens. And he wrote me back a lovely postcard with a 4-cent stamp on the postcard. And it said, thank you so much for your letter. Perhaps a simple rereading will help you. That was all it said.
Good advice. No, that's good advice. And look, I get it. Like, certainly I would never ask someone who didn't like the book to reread the book. No. I'm not saying, hey, try it again. But no, if you enjoyed it, but you had questions, give it another shot and see if those questions are answered. So sometimes they're being answered throughout and you don't know it, because the question hasn't been asked until later on.
That's what I was saying.
The answers come before the questions in many cases.
That's what I was saying. The first time I saw it, then I had to go back.
Right.
Yeah. And I just went back. Yeah. That's the cool thing. And what I was going to say too is that, you know, sometimes when you read a book and each chapter is an alternating character, which it is here, and then your table of contents, it goes on and on. Sometimes I don't like that, because if I like one character, then the next chapter, I'm thinking, I got to get through this chapter so I can go back to the character I like.
Right.
And in this one, you didn't, because all three of them, you know, had this certain something. So all three of them had a certain something, especially when you get the way, and the first time I saw The Deliverer, I'm going, oh, okay.
My wife, it's so funny. My wife, she usually doesn't, I don't like for her to read them until they're closer to being finished. And so she was reading I think the first Deliverer section happens like in page 50 or 60 or something. And she was at the first page of the Deliverer's first section. And she was like, I've read this first sentence over and over again. I'm not sure what I'm reading. And I was like, that's okay. Like, and part of it too, you know, when you're dealing with the multiple narrations is, I found, so in my second novel, I did have two alternating points of view and they were both in first person. And I just found that, if I had to do it over again, I would go back and rewrite, if not both of them in third person, at least one of them in third person. Part of it is alternating points of view in first person can get really difficult if you're in the heads of both characters the way first person is. So with this book, you've got, it's all in third person except the deliverers sections, which switches to first. And it's very jarring, but I liked that. And I toyed around with some different ways to write it, but that was the most compelling to me, because with Kit and Nico's chapters, you know, you're in third person. So the transitions between the two are a little easier, because you're not in either of their heads. But with the deliverer, when you suddenly jump to first person present, it's like, okay, wait, what's happening? And it kind of signals to the reader, okay, this is something different. And so again, it was just a really fun thing to write.
Yeah, it's hard to switch. And some authors go back and switch, and it just seems like it would be such hard work to do that. I've forgotten the name of the one who did. I'll think of it in a minute. But the other thing that was cool was, why did you create the red journals as kind of a resting stone on which to lay what he was going to do? Why are they red journals? It reminded me of Carl Jung's red journal.
Yeah, why red? I mean, I think it really is just the imagery of that, especially in a world like this where it's, you know, it's set in the post-apocalyptic woods of New Hampshire, and it's 20 years after the end of the world. There's no internet. There's no technology. Everything is kind of green and brown, and it feels very much like a muted tone kind of world. And so the imagery of having the deliverer carrying around these old tattered leather journals that were these sort of bright red color, I just found really compelling. Actually, in some of the earlier drafts, the red books, I have much longer excerpts from them, and we went through a lot of iterations about how much to reveal and how much do we need to show. That's really what the question came to when it came to the deliverers sections, and specifically the red books, was how little can we show and have it still be effective. And so I ended up cutting a ton, because I had written all of these sections about the red books and about all these different things the deliverer had done or was planning to do. And ultimately, you know, it was my editor and I kind of saying, let's like really whittle this down to the bare bones and say what is necessary. Because with a character like that, where sort of the entire thing is, it's just, yeah, again, it's with the reveals. I can't really say much, but that it was the kind of character where being very, you know, verbose and having all these extras was really at a detriment to the character. So
definitely. The only reason I asked about the red is because I sell collectible books too. And there's this crimson, like calfskin red, Moroccan leather kind of red.
Yeah.
It's so important. And I can't, there's no way I could explain it because there's no words.
Right.
Why that means so much to me, but it does. And maybe not for anybody else, but it resonated with me.
Oh, that's great. I love to hear that. And there was just sort of like, it has a ring to it. The red books, like, yeah. Kind of just felt like it, there was something to that. Yeah. I don't know. I'd never really investigated, why the color red, but I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like Carl Jung did this thing called the red book and have a first edition, first printing. He never wanted it published, and he kept it in the safe deposit box. And then his family wanted to make some money, and they did exactly the opposite, just like with Kafka, that he wanted to do. And it's beautiful. It's this illuminated script, and it's just this beautiful, beautiful book. And it has that exact, I thought of that immediately, but that's just me. But that's what you're looking for. You're looking for someone to like key in on one particular point.
And it's so interesting because you never, you know, I think most authors think, or I think a lot about, well, you know, I'm creating this book for me, but once it starts to get nearer to publication, that's for me, that's when I start thinking, oh man, people are going to read this. And that's kind of when I wonder, well, I wonder what people will connect with and like what parts, what characters. I don't think often about why a reader might connect with something. So I like thinking, I love hearing about your connection to the Red Books in that way. That was very cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of authors are, you know, the reason I get such good authors now is because they can't go out on tour. So they settle for me. But you know, it's like, if this book is in our young adult book club, which I call fight club, you know, you're going to have these people on either side arguing about certain things. Why did he put that in there? Why did she, why did someone die? Why did he make that happen? It really pissed me off. And I like when you have that, because That's what you're looking for, I think.
Yeah, you know? For sure. Yeah, you want it discussed, and you know, different authors work different ways. I read any reviews or dialogue or discourse where I'm invited to read them. So if a blogger has gone out of their way to write a review and then they tag me, then I will see that. But otherwise, it makes me nervous, and I can't go seek things out, because it's a thing that you want, but it's not a thing that I want to see. Like, I'm glad that people discuss it, but I don't need to be part of it.
Yeah, like I'm never going to watch this interview.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny because, yeah, it's like, yeah, there's this work. Well, okay, I used to ask this to everyone, but so you've written all these books, and like this press before of this was amazing, but did you feel like the first one maybe, or even now, especially since you were talking about it, when it's done, do you feel like you're like kind of sending your only child or your first child out into the world, and you're not sure whether you know, it's his first, he just got his learner's permit, and you're not sure what he went about driving and that kind of.
That's it. Exactly. It does feel very much, it sounds so cliche, but yeah, it really does feel that way. You spent, especially on a book like this, you know, so I've written 4 novels, and the first 3 took about 2 years roughly to write. This one, like I said, I had the idea in 2012, kind of worked off and on it for a few years, but kind of left it there, and then really got serious about it early 2017, and it became basically the only thing I was working on. And so for it to go out into the world now in 2021, and when I think back to the very first idea for the book happening when my kid was 6 months old, and now next month he'll be 9 years old. So it's a strange thing to watch the parallel of time, like the passage of time in my own life. And I've said before that parenting and watching your kid grow, it's like time made tangible. You know, you're watching the literal passage of time, and it's right in front of you. And so it's been a strange, very rewarding, but bizarre thing to be releasing this book now. And to know how long it's taken,
like Charles Yu says, we live in a science fictional universe. I mean, I have a 40-year-old son. He was just 3 years old yesterday.
Yeah, right. it's wild.
What the hell happened? I mean, yeah. I'm serious. I mean, I can remember we had this thing called the Spy, and it was this alien that would come to Earth, and he had missions. They were A, B, and C missions by difficulty. And there was this long wand I found somewhere in a store that had all the glitter in it. And I stuck it in the middle of the night at an angle into our garden. And the next morning we went out to look at the garden, and there's this thing.
Yeah. I love that.
And he believed it all. Well, that's the other science fiction. That was true. I mean, he believed. Right. But as far as I'm concerned, I remember that. It's just like you're talking about. It's just like each moment, you know, it's like when someone says live in the moment. Yeah, I can do that 3 or 4 times a day. But right. No, it's really hard to do. But all that kind of stuff, and now I'm rambling, but all that kind of stuff I remember perfectly. And it's like there isn't any time.
Yeah, all the cliches of parenting are true. And when I find myself thinking or rather saying or doing something that I remember my mom or my dad saying or doing, and being like, not just that I've become them, but in the ways that I think about time as it relates to my kid, and like, oh, it feels like just yesterday, you know, I was walking you with your stroller. Yep. Yeah, it's very strange.
The thing about it is, when you're an old guy like me, it's like people, when I was a kid, people will say, enjoy every moment because it's going to go really fast. Mm-hmm. Then it starts going fast. But what you don't know yet is that it starts going faster and faster.
It just keeps going, getting faster. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like almost arithmetically. And so now... me thinking back to 2017 is like, yeah, we just went to that concert, you know,
yesterday. Yeah,
if I remember the concert.
right.
The last question is funny because they bring it up in the reviews. I don't know why. So how can we set it, since you're down, I assume you're in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So why did you set it in the Northeast? Simply because it was like this mostly metropolitan area? Because they ask in the reviews, and I thought about it. I wonder why you put it there.
Yeah, so yes, it is set in the woods of New Hampshire for a couple of reasons. The main one being my wife has extended family that lives in Maine, and so we've gone up a few times and we've done a few of those drives even where it's just long stretches of winding road through the woods and mountains, and I just kind of fell in love with that part of the country. And then spending her family has some property on this mountain near Moosehead Lake, and there's this incredible deck that, you know, you stand out on this deck and you're just kind of all you see are just mountains and forest, and that would have been right around, yeah, again, I'm terrible with my own life timelines, but this would have been, you know, in the earlier part of my son's life. And kind of imagining a father telling stories to his offspring, and then what if something was happening to the dad and the kid had to you know, venture out into these woods. And so yeah, I think that kind of stuck with me a little bit, and knowing that I needed long stretches of rural woods, it just, when I was thinking about it in terms of the story, it just made the most sense. So then really what happened was I knew that the majority of it was going to be taking place in the woods, but at the very end there needed to be some sort of a ruined city that she could go find, just based on what was happening in the story. I knew that was going to be the case. So, I'd flown when we did the flight, we would fly into Manchester, New Hampshire. So I'd been to the town a couple of times, and kind of knew that it was this very cool old town with all these old mills along the river. And I thought, oh, this could be perfect. And so I did a lot of Google Earth, in terms of finding her route from where her fictional farmhouse would be, all the way through the woods to the Merrimack River, and then south through Concord, and then ultimately into Manchester. And then once I kind of landed on that, I did take two trips that were just dead up there, to just sort of dedicated to finding the spot. You know, the thing about research, when you're researching setting that's so wonderful, is you can kind of do, like I said, Google Earth to kind of get your bearings. But then there's really nothing like going to the place and experiencing it for yourself and seeing what it's like. And it kind of does two things. The first is that it kind of confirms and paints in and fills in all of the things that you had already found in your own research back home. But the second thing, and the far more important thing, is that inevitably you find some really cool little pocket of something in these towns that you never would have known about had you not gone there. So in my second research trip for the book, this would have been fall 2019. We were nearing kind of the end of the writing process. I was getting closer to saying, okay, I think, you know, the book's basically done. And I was following her route along the Merrimack River south. And I walked large swaths of it. And I was walking along right into Concord. And, you know, it's pretty rural woods, but then suddenly you're kind of in some city, and there was like this strip mall, and I walked around the strip mall just to see what some of the shops might be like, so I can kind of pepper the book with some of those specific details. And there was a Books a Million that was literally like, I mean, it was right next to the river, right next to where she would have, I'd already picked it. That she was going to be walking right by a giant bookstore. And I was just like, this is too good. So I kind of kept that Books a Million miraculously intact. And there's a scene in the book where the characters spend the night in a Books a Million. And that whole scene was so fun to write, but it was only possible because I went up there and walked that and saw the store. And so you inevitably find little pockets like that that enhance and enrich the story and the characters. And you know, traveling obviously is something that's changed for all of us. And I'm luckily in a spot with my next book where I'm not sure where it's set yet, and I don't have to make that decision immediately. But if I do put it in an actual place, my hope is that we can travel again. Cause it's hard to imagine trying to write an entire book of people that live in a certain area and not actually going to that area and seeing what it's like. So
I thought that was going to be a totally off the wall question, and it actually does give a lot of context to it. The last time I was in a Books a Million, it was like not that long ago. And I looked at their computers and they were still running DOS. I'm going, what the? And I asked her, I said, what the hell is wrong with you guys? And she goes, you wouldn't believe how cheap and our management is. And then I was thinking, well, it still works, but it just looks really funny.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years after the world ends, and the books are still in the shop. But it was cool. It was a cool full circle moment, though, because they had that specific Books a Million. I believe it is in Concord. Did a great little Electric Kingdom display, and they sent a picture through my publisher that I was able to see. And I just thought it was so cool because, you know, that during that trip, I remember walking around the shop and kind of imagining where they would sleep and how that would work. And so it was a cool thing to see the book in the place after the fact. Yeah, it was just one of those surreal author moments.
Oh, I'm glad I asked that. Yeah. Well, anyway, so I really enjoyed this, and I'm glad when we can't talk about spoilers, because that means there's spoilers, which is really cool. So, so when you do get out, when we all get out, yeah, I would love it if you came to the bookstore if you ever get up here to Pennsylvania.
I would love that. I love Philadelphia.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Sam, you as well.
Okay. See ya.
Thanks.